What does it mean to be a Western yogi? How can someone who was born and raised in the West, who comes from a Judeo-Christian background, practice yoga and meditation in an authentic and genuine way? My name is Christopher Sartain, and this is the Western Yoga Podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. It's a foggy morning here in the southern Andes Mountains at our retreat center in Chile. We just ended a very busy high season here at our retreat center. We did a 200-hour yoga teacher training in February. And had some volunteers here in March, and did a bit of traveling as well. And then in April, we had a 300-hour yoga teacher training, followed by a Kriya Yoga retreat. And during that retreat, I had the honor of authorizing three new Kriya Yoga Masters, who will now be authorized to teach Kriya Yoga and offer Kriya Yoga initiations and have their own students in the future and all of that. So that was a very, very important time for me personally, having spent 10 years teaching Kriya Yoga in Chile. I finally felt ready to authorize others, some of my students, to begin teaching Kriya Yoga and offering initiations, and to continue the transmission of these teachings and these techniques. So that was a very important step for me in my teaching efforts here in South America. And I really see it as sort of the completion of my service for the Kriya Yoga path and the Kriya Yoga gurus, my guru, Roy Eugene Davis, and all of that. And so I really feel a sense of contentment and satisfaction with what we've been able to accomplish here in the last decade. Today, in this episode, I would like to discuss the yugas and the secret history of humanity, the secret history of the world. And so what exactly are the yugas? Well, the yugas are a series of four ages that occur, astrological ages that occur here on the planet. And it is part of a cycle that takes around 24,000 years to complete. Although I think it's a bit longer, I think it's connected to the so-called precession of the equinoxes. That is a 26,000 year cycle. But I don't want to get into the weeds and go into a lot of complicated math in this episode. But needless to say, I believe there is a connection between this 26,000-year cycle of the precession of the equinoxes and this 24,000-year cycle of the yugas. And I think Sri Yukteswar also understood that connection. Prior to Sri Yukteswar's correction of the mathematical errors regarding the yugas, it was thought that the yugas lasted for hundreds of thousands of years, or even millions of years, the cycles were very, very long until Sri Yukteswar discovered the mathematical errors, which, again, I will not go into. Although I highly recommend to read Sri Yukteswar's book, The Holy Science, in which he details his discoveries regarding the yugas and their duration. I also highly recommend to read the book, The Yugas, by Joseph Selby, which is a description of all of the yugas and how it relates to human history. It's an excellent book, and it explains so much about human history and the secret history of humanity and the planet. I can't recommend that book enough, both of the books. Until you've read both of those books, you really have no grasp over the real history of humanity and the real history of the planet. So, these yugas are divided into four ages, and there is a descending cycle that occurs, going from the most enlightened age, Satya, to the dark age, Kali, and then an ascending cycle, 12,000-year cycle, that goes from Kali to Satya. So the descending cycle lasts about 12,000 years, then the ascending cycle lasts 12,000 years. And we are currently in the ascending part of the cycle, and we're just sort of on the cusp of leaving Kali Yuga, entering Dwapara Yuga, and we're on the ascending part of this, the ascending 12,000 year part of this larger 24,000 year cycle of the yugas. I will not go into a complicated explanation, but I will say that essentially there seems to be a sort of vortex of energy at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. When our solar system gets closest to that center of the Milky Way galaxy, that vortex, we experience Satya Yuga. Okay? When our solar system is furthest away from that vortex, we experience Kali Yuga. The idea being that there are some evolutionary forces, Kundalini or Shakti, if you want, residing in that vortex, and as our solar system approaches, those evolutionary influences of that vortex, we experience an enlightened age, or Satya Yuga. When our solar system is furthest away from that evolutionary force, we experience a dark age, or Kali Yuga. And so this cycle repeats itself over and over and over again, so that humanity has already experienced several Satya Yugas, has experienced several cycles. Looks like Homo sapiens sapiens have been, or at least Homo sapiens, have been on the planet for around 300,000 years-ish, maybe longer. We're not entirely sure, but we'll go with that for now. So, you know, we've experienced several rounds of this 24,000 or 26,000 year cycle already. And so there's nothing new under the sun. And at any rate, we have exited Kali Yuga, and we have entered into the beginnings of Dwapara Yuga, And so we are no longer in the darkest age, although its effects are still being felt, even in this new Dwapara Yuga. And so, in other words, we are still suffering the effects of the dark age, even though we have technically moved into Dwapara Yuga. Each Yuga is associated with, a lot, but essentially Satya Yuga is thought to be an enlightened age or a spiritual age. Treta Yuga is thought to be a mental age. Dwapara Yuga is thought to be an energy age. And Kali Yuga is a material age or a dark age. Essentially, the last Satya Yuga ended around 7000 BC, approximately. We then experienced a mental age until around 3000 BC, approximately. Treta Yuga until 3000 BC, mental age. And then we experienced Dwapara Yuga, which is an energy age. It ended around 700 BC. And then we experienced Kali Yuga, both the descending part and the ascending part. Yeah, and it ended around 1700 AD. Well, there's a cusp also that occurs in between yugas. But essentially, the worst parts of Kali Yuga ended around 1700 BC, or AD. Okay? And we've been experiencing the beginning parts of Dwapara Yuga ever since. And essentially, during Satya Yuga, the majority of humanity is rather enlightened. Enlightenment becomes a priority for most people. And society is set up and designed to promote spiritual enlightenment. And in Kali Yuga, the opposite is true. Society forgets about enlightenment, forgets about its spiritual nature. Although, even in Kali Yuga, there are still a few enlightened people on the planet, typically maintaining spiritual teachings and techniques and whatnot. But the overwhelming majority of people live in complete spiritual ignorance and darkness. And much of the spiritual science of Satya Yuga is forgotten during Kali Yuga, and even Dwapara Yuga to a certain extent. During Treta Yuga, which is the mental age, it is still a rather enlightened age, and people maintain a lot of so-called psychic abilities or supernatural abilities, the siddhis, so-called, in the yoga texts. And people are able to communicate telepathically. They have powers of telekinesis and a lot of psychic abilities, remote viewing abilities, and all of that. In the energy age, Dwapara Yuga, people still have access to a lot of their knowledge regarding subtle energies, prana, the telluric energies, or earth prana, basically. And they have access to electricity and things of that nature. And in Kali Yuga, it's a dark age where people live in ignorance. There's a lot of human suffering, and much of the spiritual science and material science also is lost for a time, although it is preserved in secret priesthoods, secret societies, secret brotherhoods and whatnot, and is rekindled in the later stages of Dwapara Yuga and Treta Yuga, moving back into Satya Yuga. We will not experience another Satya Yuga for many thousands of years. Treta Yuga also will be a few thousand years before we experience the benefits of Treta Yuga. Now, a lot of spiritual seekers don't like to hear this, and they find it very emotionally uncomfortable and psychologically uncomfortable to accept the fact that we are just leaving a dark age and that we currently live in a very dark age. It is what it is. It's just something we have to accept. The evidence, by the way, is all around us. One can simply turn on the news and look at the current state of affairs in the world and easily deduce the fact that we're still living in a dark age. This is not a great secret or anything that is hidden from our view. It's quite obvious when we look around. Now, in Satya Yuga, people also live much longer. They have much longer lifespans, and they are much healthier. And again, spiritual enlightenment becomes a priority. Society is designed so that people can pursue their spiritual enlightenment, and so that they can practice their sadhana, their spiritual practices, in peace and tranquility. And this is promoted within societies and civilizations. Atlantis, or Lemuria, or Mu, these ancient lost civilizations, existed during Satya Yuga. Okay? And there was a great catastrophe that occurred in the so-called Younger Dryas period, which is a geologic term used to describe this sort of mini ice age that occurred. From around 12,800 years ago to around 11,600 years ago. I believe that's right. Something like that, if I remember correctly. And this was a period of drastic cooling that occurred due to what was most likely a comet, or at least partial comet impact that occurred prior to that. And it created global cooling that and flooding, global flooding, once the planet began to warm back up. A lot of the ice that had accumulated during the Younger Dryas cooling period began to melt rapidly, and it created a lot of global flooding and devastation. And so the coupling of the extremely cold temperatures along with the rapid warming and flooding, this destroyed a lot of the civilizations, advanced civilizations that existed during that time, during Satya Yuga. And we've applied many names to these civilizations: Atlantis, Lemuria, Mu, to name but a few. And, of course, we don't know what these civilizations were actually called or what they called themselves, but these are names that have been ascribed to these lost civilizations. We have evidence of these lost civilizations in the architecture that remains and the ruins that remain in places like Egypt and Bolivia and Peru and other places. The giant megalithic constructions that used huge, huge stones. Another example would be Baalbek, Lebanon, where some of the stones are 100 tons or more. Huge stones that our modern machinery, modern cranes, could not lift. So, in other words, we are incapable of moving these stones with our modern technology. But yet, if you ask an archaeologist or historian, they will tell you that we are at the peak of our human evolution and development. How can that be if our modern technology is incapable of moving some of these stones that humans were able to move some 12,000 years ago when these structures were constructed? Now, historians and archaeologists also will tell you that those structures are not as old as that. They're not 12,000 years old, and that human beings were incapable of building anything on that scale, you know, 12,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. And that was fine, really, until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which we now know is a 12,000-year-old structure that uses large megalithic stones, nothing on the scale of you know, Lebanon or Egypt or Bolivia or Peru, but large megalithic stone structures, and which was thought to have been impossible, you know, 30, 40 years ago, until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe and Kerahan Tepe and all the other structures there in Turkey, that we now know were built around 12,000 years ago and are quite sophisticated, very sophisticated structures with large megalithic stones, the so-called T-pillars and whatnot. So we now know that humans were in fact building large sophisticated megalithic structures 12,000 years ago. And so that pushes everything back, and now we can look at the structures in Egypt and Peru and Bolivia, and we can deduce that probably those structures are equally as old, if not even older, due to some findings by researchers regarding astroarchaeology, where they look at alignments with certain stars or constellations or even the poles and whatnot, and they are able to deduce through mathematical means when those structures were built based upon the alignments and what the alignments, you know, were like, you know, 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 years ago, etc. It's quite complicated, so I won't go into a lot of that. But needless to say, there is evidence of an advanced lost civilization. My best friend, Renato Longato, is a Peruvian researcher, currently lives in California. I knew him when he lived in Georgia. We spent a lot of time together, and I learned a great deal from him about many things. He's a rather brilliant individual. But at any rate, he researches a lot of the megalithic structures around Cusco, Peru, which I've had the great privilege to visit a couple of times, and spent quite a bit of time there doing my own research, at any rate. And he is in contact with some researchers, geologists, and other scientists who have discovered that the giant megalithic blocks, especially around Sacsayhuaman, which is just outside of Cusco, with these huge polygonal blocks, multi-ton, huge, massive blocks. Actually, they have discovered that there is a layer of geopolymer, or cement, or concrete, rather, that encases these giant stones and was used to prevent weathering on those stones. And so, and also when you look at these stones, I mean, the precision cuts of these stones and the way they fit together seamlessly, I mean, there's no space in between them. These are earthquake-proof walls and structures. And the technology must have been incredibly sophisticated. If you ask an archaeologist there, they will tell you that they built all of these structures with bronze chisels, and they dragged them in place with ropes. I'm sorry, but I mean, if you go there, it becomes quite obvious. Even people with absolutely no knowledge or expertise can tell right away that that these structures were not in fact built with bronze tools or dragged into place by ropes. It's just kind of goofy to even think that way, but you know, so-called experts will tell you that. At any rate, I won't go into a long diatribe about all of that. But needless to say, these structures seem to be quite ancient, and they are remnants of an advanced lost civilization. Call it whatever you want. But this civilization did exist around Satyayuga. Now, you won't find any writing on any of these structures, the Great Pyramids, the structures in Peru or Bolivia, the structures in Lebanon. And Satyayuga, they did not, apparently, use a lot of writing, and that's because it just wasn't necessary. People lived very long lives, they had excellent memories, extraordinary mental and psychic abilities, and they were able to communicate telepathically, and there was just really no need to write. There's no need to write anything down. They had language, of course, but there's just really no need to write it down. And they just existed in a completely different type of reality that we can't even imagine. And they had as their priority spiritual enlightenment. And so they built these amazingly beautiful temple structures and pyramids to promote enlightenment and to promote ascension. And so their goal was to graduate from this physical realm and ascend to the more subtle astral realms, or possibly even just more advanced physical planets, but also the subtle, refined astral realms and possibly causal realms, these other higher dimensions. And so their goal, their objective during their lifetimes was to have a nice, long, healthy life so that they could purify all their karma, learn spiritual secrets, and graduate from the physical plane so that they could ascend to the higher astral dimensions. And so their society and civilization was designed around that, around enlightenment and around ascension. And we can see in the architecture, especially in Bolivia and Peru, there's a design called the Chicana. It's basically looks like three, it's called the Inca cross, although it predates the Inca by many thousands of years. But you can look it up online. But it has these three little steps, and the number three was very important to the ancients of Peru and Bolivia. And also, you do see in the cosmology, the Inca cosmology, the number three, this Inca cross, and the symbolism of the serpent, puma, and condor. It's in all the artwork around there. And essentially, the serpent represents the material world, the puma represents the astral world, and the condor represents the causal world, or causal plane, the mental plane. And so you see, in the ancient architecture and cosmology of the Andes, the knowledge of reincarnation, ascension, and the three planes or three dimensions of existential reality. And so their entire civilization was based around this knowledge of the three planes. Probably during Satya Yuga, the humans living at that time most likely had interactions with astral beings and causal beings frequently or regularly, and they had full knowledge of this process of ascension, of the three planes, of the three dimensions, physical, astral, and causal. And it's quite evident in their architecture and their symbolism. It's all over the place when you go to Bolivia and Peru, even in northern Chile a bit. At any rate, you also see three layers of architecture, or three periods of architecture in Bolivia and Peru. And there is a cosmology around that as well. And there are three basic ages in the Andean cosmology. Anan Pacha, Uran Pacha, and Ukun Pacha. And if you look at the dates of those three ages, they correspond quite nicely with the idea of Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, and Dwapara and Kali Yuga combined for Ukun Pacha. But Anan Pacha seems to correspond with Satya Yuga, Uran Pacha with Treta Yuga, and Ukun Pacha with Dwapara and Kali. And so when you look at the three levels of architecture in Peru, the first level, Anan Pacha, which corresponds with Satya Yuga, are simply, it's basically just modifications made to the bedrock, the living rock. So they weren't building with large megalithic blocks or anything. They were just cutting into the bedrock, making caves and caverns and tunnels and a lot of meditation seats. You go to a place like Kenko, just above Cusco, just above Sacsayhuaman, and Kenko and Kenko Chico, and you see... it's all over the place, but that's just one example. But you see all these amazing tunnels and caves cut out, and just all these series of meditation seats and meditation thrones and whatnot. It's really amazing. And it looks like they just melted the stone. It has this very smooth, vitrified texture to it. It just looks like the stone was melted with some kind of high-tech laser or something. And just these perfect right angle cuts, cut right out of the stone, just really beautiful craftsmanship. And obviously they had access to some type of high-tech cutting tools using very high heat or energy that we don't understand anymore to cut all of these tunnels and caves and meditation seats and whatnot. And so when we look at that, and we look at Hanumanpacha, so-called, it does seem to correspond to Satyayuga in that whoever made all of those structures, it just looks like it was a real nice place to practice your sadhana. You go there and that's the vibe you get. It's just like, oh, okay, people were just coming here to meditate, to practice their sadhana, and not much else. And then you go on to Oranpacha, which is the next layer of architecture, which corresponds with Treta Yuga, or the mental age. And these are the large, huge, megalithic structures you find around Cusco, Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, even in Machu Picchu to a certain extent, and over in Lake Titicaca in Bolivia, around the structures of Pumapunku, Tiwanaku, using these huge megalithic blocks. Now, it seems to me that whoever built those structures was capable of moving large blocks mentally with telekinesis, their telepathic or psychic supernatural abilities. They were able to just use their powers to literally just float these rocks into place. If that sounds rather fantastical, there are more recent reports of Tibetan monks doing this with chanting mantras and blowing these horns, playing all these instruments and whatnot, concentrating their psychic powers on large stones and being able to float and move large stones psychically. There are several reports within the last 100 years, 150 years, let's say, of Tibetan monks doing just that. For anyone who doubts that is possible, there are legitimate reports of Tibetan monks doing that. And so probably during Treta Yuga, or the mental age, or Oranpacha, so-called in the Andean cosmology, humans during that mental age were capable of doing that. And so you see these large megalithic structures, especially the polygonal structures, these were most likely built during this Oranpacha, or Treta Yuga, the mental age. And so during that age, people still possessed a lot of their psychic abilities, mental abilities, telepathic abilities. But we did see, especially toward the end of Treta Yuga, a lot of social hierarchy coming into play, and there was less social equality, and people began to socially stratify, and you do see during that period royalty and political leadership coming into play, and social stratification, social hierarchy, and sort of the end of the prioritization of enlightenment and sadhana and ascension and all of that, and a lowering of the collective human consciousness. So that by the time we get to Ukunpacha, which is Dwapara and Kali Yuga, we begin to see very rudimentary structures, the so-called Inca structures, that are very rudimentary in comparison to the older, much older structures. And so that we know that the Inca empire had nothing to do with the building of the older structures. As a matter of fact, when the conquistadors arrived there, the Inca told them just that. They say, we don't know who built these. It wasn't us. These are far older. And we built our structures around or on top of these far older structures because, you know, we revere and honor our ancestors and all of that. And it's very, very obvious that the three strata or the three layers of Andean architecture in Peru and Bolivia. It's extremely obvious. Again, anyone with zero training, zero expertise can immediately see that there are, in fact, three totally different, three totally distinct types of architecture and building there in the Andes. And these correspond very nicely with Satya Yuga, the Golden Age, Treta Yuga, the Mental Age, and Dwapara Yuga, the Energetic Age, and then going, descending completely into Kali Yuga during the Inca times and the times of the conquistadors' arrival in the Americas and all of that. And so this is a very real thing, that the Yugas are real, and it becomes quite apparent. And by the way, you can also see the same three levels in Egypt and some other places. And so essentially, during Satya Yuga, again, ascension was a priority. Sadhana was a priority. Enlightenment was a priority. And descending into Treta Yuga, less and less, Dwapara Yuga, less and less, into Kali Yuga, it's not a priority at all. And if there is any spirituality, it's mostly based around power structures and organized religions and religious organizations, based around spiritually ignorant belief systems, primarily. But it seems as though there were secret groups or secret priesthoods, let's say, or secret societies that preserved, that guarded the teachings around enlightenment, reincarnation, ascension, and all of that. There were secret priesthoods that maintained, that guarded, that preserved all of those teachings for future generations, even during the darkest of times. Now, if you look into this, you will find the works of people like Helena Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, and many others, and the Theosophy movements and other sort of occult teachings. You will find mention of the Great White Brotherhood. White here has nothing to do with race. It refers to light, enlightenment, purity, and whatnot. But it was believed that there was sort of this secret priesthood that has existed since Satya Yuga. In other words, there were survivors of these cataclysms. Okay, so survivors of Atlantis, if you will, that somehow escaped the destruction and moved to various parts of the planet to recatalyze civilization in various parts of the world. Let's say possibly Egypt, possibly Sumeria, Turkey even, maybe Lebanon, Mexico, and here in South America. And so groups of this secret priesthood were located at various different parts of the planet, and they did a good job of preserving these teachings and techniques from Satya Yuga in various parts of the world for future generations. And I'm not sure that they ever used the term, you know, Great White Brotherhood. I have no idea. But at any rate, it does look like the teachings of Satchi Yuga were preserved for thousands of years in secret priesthoods, in secret societies. And it does seem as though these groups continued to interact with so-called avatars or astral beings, advanced masters existing in astral planes. And they were able to preserve the teachings up until the present. One such avatar, I believe, was Mahavatar Babaji, the first guru in my lineage of Kriya Yoga. He was, or is, an astral being, or some say even a causal being, that can manifest a physical adult body at will in order to interact with some advanced students and seekers here on the planet when need be. And he tended to live in the Himalayas. And he was one of these avatars that interacted with humans from time to time to preserve these teachings. One person that he interacted with was Lahiri Mahashaya in the 1800s in the Himalayas. Lahiri studied with him for a couple of weeks in his cave. And the secrets of Satchi Yuga were revealed to him, specific techniques and teachings and whatnot. Now, a lot of these teachings were preserved in the yoga texts, and so that it was nothing new, really, but what was new was the fact that this avatar or representative of this secret priesthood, let's say, gave Lahiri Mahashaya permission to bring these teachings back out into the public sphere. So that's what was different or revolutionary about that. And so it's interesting that that was occurring just at the end of Kali Yuga and the beginning of Dwapara Yuga, when the planet was beginning to reawaken spiritually. Isn't that an interesting synchronicity or coincidence? That right at that time, you have this highly advanced astral being interacting with a person here on the planet and permitting him to take these advanced meditation techniques and teachings about reincarnation, ascension, and everything back out into the public sphere. In other words, you didn't have to be a yogi living in deep in the Himalayas or in an ashram somewhere or whatever in order to practice these advanced techniques. Any householder, any normal person now was able to practice these techniques and have access to these teachings again. And so other examples of these avatars, Saint Germain, I highly recommend to research this individual, a fascinating, rather enlightened being that lived during sort of medieval Europe during that period, and interacted in a lot of the royal palaces with royalty and the aristocracy of his day. He was a vegetarian. He had knowledge that he could not have gained unless he was a being that had been alive for thousands of years. It's just a fascinating history. At any rate, there are several examples of these avatars occasionally interacting with people during Kali Yuga and now in Dwapara Yuga to preserve the teachings for future generations so that they are not completely lost. And so the good news is we are out of Kali Yuga. We're moving into Dwapara Yuga. And this new energy age of Dwapara Yuga, it's quite interesting because just in the last couple of hundred years, of course, we've rediscovered electricity, nuclear energy, all kinds of energy sources. And so that is no coincidence, as we are moving into the energy age, that we have rediscovered all of these energies. Of course, due to our low collective consciousness, we tend to use a lot of these energies for war and for weapons, and to destroy the planet and the environment and whatnot. And that is the holdover from Kali Yuga that is still affecting our consciousness as we move into the energy age. But the good news is that we are in an ascending cycle, and things will slowly improve, hopefully, in the next few hundred years. None of us, of course, will be around to see that. But all we can do in our current age is to be beacons of light, and to be that light in the darkness. As a yogi, as a spiritual seeker, that is your mission, that is your duty, that is your dharma in this life, is to be a light bearer and to be a beacon of light during this dark age, and to preserve the legacy of Atlantis, the legacy of Satya Yuga in our dark age, so that these teachings are not lost, and so that future generations will know about ascension, reincarnation, enlightenment, and all of that. And so that is our duty and our calling. I will talk more about the yugas in future episodes of the Western Yoga Podcast. I sincerely hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share it with like-minded individuals. Lots of love. Namaste.